слышно се нашата сестрична вечер. Но ни трябва приятели, но не разбираме да бъдат някакви тези споделени от църква и по-добре са ни приемивате на статива за регулиране на авторски права. Зато, без да дължим на проекта от проектата, имаме чест в рамките на проекта Национална политика за слабен софтуер в организация на слабена софтуер академия, поддържана от фундацията на Камафузис и фундацията от Вайна в Система Катония, да се работа с Министерството за дипломатическо общество, да го представим на човека, който иска да дискутира, като дискутира закон за авторски права, автора на проекта от Кому и общата работа на лицензия Чеки. Господин Ричард Стамо.
Software nobody has power over anybody else. But with proprietary
the software, the program controls the users. And the developer controls the program, which means the developer controls the users. And that free program is an instrument giving some developer or some company power over the people who fall into the trap of using it. And that's what that bad free program is. It's a trap. Because to use it, you must lose your freedom. So, developing a free program is a contribution to society. How much that depends on the details, of course. Developing a proprietary program is not a contribution, it's a program, an attempt to lure people to fall into your trap. And once you, the developer, have power over them, you can give them orders, you can exploit them, you can abuse them through the program. So, the goal of the free software movement is that all software be free so that all the users of software can be free. It's impossible to use a computer and have freedom if you're doing it with proprietary software. So, escaping to the free world has to be our goal. The free world is the free software community, which we have built so that we can have a place to live in freedom. I launched the free software movement in 1983. I began developing a free software operating system called GNU. In 1992, GNU was almost finished, but there was one important piece that was missing. That's the program called the Kernel, which allocates the computer's resources to all the other programs in RAM. In 1992, Mr. Torvalds, who had written a kernel called Linux, made it free software. And so GNU plus Linux became a complete free operating system, which is used by millions of people now, and most of them think it's Linux, which is not. You see, please don't call it Linux. It's not recognized in that way if you call it Linux. If you call it GNU plus Linux, then you're giving us equal mention. Please do that. In any case, once the system started to have more users, it started getting invited to give a lot of speeches about free software. And after I officially a speech about free software, I'll explain why each of those four freedoms is essential, and I'll say more about the history of the movement and the threats that we face. But after that, people would sometimes ask, do these same ideas apply to anything else? Should other things be free? Like, what about hardware? About its physical objects? Should they be free in the same sense? Well, that's the question that I'm going to address today. Of course, when they ask you about physical objects, that is intentionally foolish. Because, consider, what does it mean for physical objects to be free in this sense? It means you have the same four freedoms. And let's see. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, becomes the freedom to use the object as you wish. And you have that freedom. If you buy a physical object, you have that freedom. Okay, good, you have freedom zero. What about freedom one, the freedom to study the source code of the object and then change it so the object does what you wish? Well, here we run into a problem. Physical objects are not generally made by compiling source code. So this freedom is, well, we said it makes no sense for them. We can adapt it. It could be the freedom to study the object and then change the object to make it do what you wish. But you have that freedom. If you buy an object, you're free to change it. Except that the practical possibility of doing so could be rather limited. For instance, look at these chairs. These chairs seem to be made of metal. It's not easy to make any change in metal. things you could do to make it fair. That you might actually want to do. But we know that it's not hard. This is an example of something generally true. The ability to change physical objects can be rather limited. For instance, to change a computer chip, that's impossible. Any attempt to change it can only destroy it. And that's not because anybody's being mean, it's just the nature of them. So, we have freedom here, but the nature of reality limits our ability to use it. What about freedom to redistribute exact copies of an object? Well, the problem is there are no copiers for those kinds of physical objects. Now, you might buy a chair, or a computer, or a microphone. There are no copiers for chairs, computers, and microphones. So the question of whether we are allowed to use them is a meaningless and irrelevant question. Like that freedom thing, suppose you have a wooden chair and you modify it and it looks nicer, and other people with the right chairs just like it, you still have no chair copy. There's no way you can make copies of your modified chair except by building them one by one, which is very laborious. So, for physical objects, the answer to that question is simple. You've got these freedoms to the extent that they don't make any sense at all. So, if it were just about physical objects, it would be a silly question. I don't want to give a speech about it. But there is something else that we can ask this question about. There are things for which we can copy and we can change, and the question of whether we are allowed to do so is a real and important question. And those are various kinds of works of authorship that we may have copies of. And we can use our computers to copy them and change them. Now, that, therefore, is the real subject of my talk. What should we be allowed to do with our copies of published works? Now, for the most part, if you have a copy of a published work, the only thing that will restrict you in what you do with it is copyright law. So the same question asked from the other side is, what should copyright law say about our copies of published works? To look at this question, it's useful to look at the history of copying technology, because copyright developed along with copying technology. Now, changes in technology can't alter our basic moral principles. Those are too deep to be touched by changes in technology. But when we consider any particular question, the moral principles is to look at the consequences of the various things we might do. And changes in the context can alter the consequences of the same action and make it more good or more bad than it used to be. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, then murder would not be very bad. If you killed somebody, the judge would know you have to pay for his dead body. And then, now, in the U.S., of course, we would have to have uninsured murder insurance in case we were killed by somebody who couldn't afford to pay. But in civilized countries, the National Health Service would take care of it. So let's look at the history of copying technology and copyright. Copying began in the ancient world. It was done with a writing instrument or a writing surface. You would read one copy and you'd write another copy. This technology was very slow, very inefficient. It had some other interesting characteristics. First of all, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies would take you 10 times as long as making one copy, approximately. Second, it required no special skill other than literacy. If you know how to read and write, you have Can be seen standing in this statement. First of all, the Constitution doesn't require copyright. Congress should have the power to. It doesn't say Congress shall, it just says Congress can. Because otherwise, copyright would have been unconstitutional and impossible. But it's not required. Second, if there is to be a copyright system, it has to be justified by promoting progress, which is a benefit for the public. The purpose of copyright under the U.S. Constitution is not for the sake of authors, let alone publishers, but rather for the sake of the general public. And third, it has to last for a limited time. Now, copyright in the age of the printing press functioned as an industrial regulation. Restricted publishers. And the restriction was controlled by authors. And the system was set up to provide benefits to the general public. In fact, in the first few centuries of printing, including in the 1700s when the U.S. Constitution was written, in fact, lots of poor people copied books by hand, still. Because printed copies were too expensive for them. But they had the time available to buy the copy. However, nobody ever thought of trying to restrict them or their activity using copyright law. Everyone understood it was supposed to be an industrial regulation. And because it was functioned as an industrial regulation, it was mostly uncontroversial, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial for the public. It was mostly uncontroversial because the readers were not restricted in anything they could feasibly do, so they had no occasion to complain. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers, and that's easy. It's easy to see who's publishing the book. And the publisher can't have it if they continue to do business. So if you need to see them, it's easy. And this doesn't require invading everybody's home or everybody's internet connection. And it's arguably beneficial because, according to the legal theory, the public made a trade with the authors. The public traded away its natural right to copy anything, which it couldn't exercise anyway. And no one tried to stop that. And so, in effect, the public traded something that it couldn't use, and in exchange got some benefit, namely more books being written than you could then buy and read. So, if you have something that's of no use to you, and you sell it, and you got something for it, it's a positive deal. And it didn't bother the readers, and if this was still in the age of the printing press, I wouldn't be objecting. But the age of the printing press is slowly giving way to another age, to another advance in copying technology, namely the computer networks. Digital information technology is another advance in copying and manipulating information. And it makes it easier and more efficient to copy things. And once again, this improvement is not uniform. Here's the way it was in the age of the printing press. Multi-time copying, still as slow and expensive as in the ancient world, but mass production was very efficient. Digital technology gives us a situation like this, that they have both benefited, but now the difference between mass production and one-off copying is not so big. So this brings us back to a situation more like the ancient world, where making one copy is reasonable to do. Now, it's not result is that carbon might not no longer operate as an industrial population. Even if the rules of renewable are changed, now it would restrict each and every one of us. The result is now carbon might no longer is a restriction of the general public controlled by the purposes in the middle of the office. Everything has been Even if the laws were the same, the effect is totally different. The result is now it's not uncontroversial, it's not easy to enforce, and it's not beneficial. It's no longer uncontroversial because now the general public is being restricted in ways that are rather nasty and offensive. The public is complaining. It's not easy to enforce because now it has to be enforced against every citizen, and that requires nasty moves to get people to do what is obviously not fair. And finally, it's no longer beneficial because the freedom that we used to trade away and never miss it because we were unable to exercise it. Now we can exercise it, and we want to exercise it. So what would a democratic government that wants to represent the people do in this situation? It would reduce copyright power. It would give back to us some of the freedom that it traded away on our behalf. We can measure the sickness of democracy around the world by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. By increasing copyright power just when the existing power is already intolerable. They do this because they are governments of occupation on behalf of the empire of the mega corporations. They don't serve the people. Their purpose, their goal, is to serve corporations by keeping the people down. And what do we do? There is a dimension of time. How long should copyright last? In recent years, waves of copyright time extension have gone around the world. In the US, copyright's length was extended several times in recent decades. The last time was in 1998, they extended copyright by 20 years for both past and future works. But they said that this was supposed to provide more incentive to write more books, giving lip service to the Constitution. But I don't see how we could encourage the authors of the 1920s and 1930s to write more by giving them 20 more years of copyright now. For one thing, they're probably dead. They would need a time machine. And if they have one, they haven't used it. We don't read in our history books that in 1920-something, when all the authors and artists discovered that their copyrights would be extended and extended in the future, that they all started writing and composing with renewed vigor. Why would they use the time machine? At least they'll get us some more classics like the one we didn't listen to. Now, for future books, it's at least conceivable that extending copyright by 20 more years would create more motivation to make those works, but not fully rational. Because, as a premise would explain to you, the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright, essentially the future, is not going to be enough to motivate you to change any decision today. Copyright formally lasted until 50 years after the author's death, and that extended it to 70. Well, that could easily be well more than a century. It's not
Spirit features, and digital input.
principles either the users control the software or the software controls the users. With proprietary software, the program controls the users, and the developer controls the program. So if a developer gets the idea to put something malicious in the program, the users can't fix it. They can't take out this malicious feature. They can't escape except by not using that program, which is what we should always do, not use that program. But this is where the temptation is so great, because you give somebody power over the users, and this, if he's greedy, what's he going to do? He's going to look for ways to take advantage of that power, and often those ways involve doing things that are malicious to the users he has subjugated. My first song, in DVDs. DVDs are designed to restrict the user. Usually, the video in the DVD is encrypted. And the purpose of this encryption is specifically to restrict what the users can do. Of course, the format was secret. That's why they were able to succeed in their goal, because the people in the company said that started this, they formed a conspiracy. And they said, anyone that wants to build DVD players has to join the conspiracy and promise to make their DVD players restrict the user just like all the other DVD players. That's why all the DVD players have more or less the same restrictions. They impose more or less the same restrictions on the public. Because they're made by members of this conspiracy. And this worked for a while, but then people figured out the encryption format and published a free program capable of decrypting the video on a DVD. Which meant you could use this free program and without letting anyone have power over you, you could watch the video on a DVD. So, the movie companies paid for another model to censor that software. It began in the U.S. in 1998 with the Digital Marketing and Copyright Act, an extremely evil law that prohibits the distribution of the free software that you can use to watch the DVD. So if you were in the U.S., and I'm glad you're not, because it's not a place where the government respects human rights. But if you were, one right you would normally have is if you bought a DVD, you have the right to watch it. But the free software you can watch it with is censored. And so it decides not just in the U.S., because the same companies have been buying rights in other parts of the world. For instance, there's a European Union directive to do the same thing. And in France, for instance, one can be sentenced to prison for merely possessing a copy of the software. Since I go to France from time to time, I decided not to have a copy. So I have no way to play an encrypted DVD. And I have no encrypted DVDs. I just never use them. Because I have nothing I could play them with. So I won't buy and won't rent an encrypted DVD. I won't even accept one as a gift. In India, I bought DVDs of Indian classical bands. But I verified first that they were not and suffering, but otherwise you feel rejected. So, the movie companies, despite getting these laws in many countries, realize that they can't make that program disappear. In fact, it's easier to get. Lots of people have copies. But, so they decided to design a new system of digital handcuffs to replace the old one. It's called AACS, but that's sometimes called the X. And it might seem that this would never be broken. But then several years ago, someone released a free program capable of decrypting that. However, in practice, it was useless because it wouldn't do anything without the key. And no one knew where the key was. And then I saw a photo of two adorable puppies. And above them were 32 X digits. And I wondered, when I put those digits together with the puppies, I wonder if those numbers are some important key. And so I put them together with the puppies, figuring that people would copy this photo because the puppies are so cute. And that way the key would be saved from it. Official attempts to erase it. And that's what it was. That was the key to break the X. And it was posted on Dig, and the editors deleted it. And it was posted again, and they deleted it. And after it had been posted hundreds of times, they finally said, "We give up, we can't delete this. After a couple of weeks, searchers found 700,000 web pages without a copy of this key. Unfortunately, this didn't win the war because the movie companies changed the key. And it's worse than that. That was enough to break the digital handcuffs on HD-DVD discs, but not in no way because it has another level of DRM. And as far as I know, there's still no free software to break that. So you mustn't ever use Blu-ray discs. They are an attack on your freedom and they are intolerable. They have to be thought of as poison. Now, you might wonder how do I know that AACS was set up by a conspiracy of companies? The reason is, it's not secret. This conspiracy has a website where it proudly states its rules, or at least it did when I looked. And one of the rules was, for instance, that starting, I think, in 2013, manufacturers will be forbidden to make analog video outputs. The only outputs allowed will be special, encrypted digital video outputs designed for networks that are also designed to attack the user's freedom. That's what they're doing. They're designing all the hardware to attack our freedom. And all of our hardware we have to regard as enemy. Also listed the companies that started the conspiracy. I think they were Intel, AMD, Microsoft, Apple, IBM, Disney, Sony, and Philips. So those are the ones who are the main conspirators in this attack on our freedom. Now, conspiracy of companies to attack our freedom ought to be treated as a serious crime. The executives of those companies might go to jail for trying, just as if they had conspired to fix prices. But they know that our governments are on their side against us, so they don't even bother to hide. That's what's happening with DRM. in video, but we've seen Telegram also in music. About 10 years ago, we started to see things that looked like compact discs, but they were not written according to the standard for compact discs, so we called them compact discs. They call themselves CDs, but they were not real compact discs. And in some countries in Europe, they are required to label them differently. They can't use the compact disc logo. So that's helpful. That way you can at least tell that it's not a real compact disc. Once I gave a speech about this topic in Spain, where I've been invited by a part of the regional government, and afterwards they gave me some books with beautiful photos of the region and some discs of music. And I wanted to listen to one of them, but fortunately, before I opened the package, I noticed the symbol that said copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems, not a much better Mac computer. So I handed it back and I said, "Here you see the face of the enemy. Please give this back to the store because they shouldn't keep your money." And I've never heard that music. I feel sorry for that musician, for what they did to him. They would have liked to hear that his name before. But they may never hear that music. I'm certainly not going to play it with proprietary software, and if I can't break the digital impress, I will have the product. Sony had a very clever idea for making compact discs. Their idea was, if you put the disc on the computer, some software on the disc will get automatically installed into the machine. And this software was like a virus, or a hack that a cracker uses to take control of the machine. It's called a rootkit. And what it does is, it installs itself inside the operating system, and now it changes the functioning of the operating system. One thing it does is restrict the use of the music on the disc, but that's the error. It also changed the functioning of a command that we would use to investigate what was in the operating system so that people would be unable to detect that this software had installed itself. It also altered the command to delete things so that trying to delete this software in the usual way would have no effect. Just like a virus. Now, this is a serious crime. People could have gone to jail for this. But it's not the only serious crime Sony committed. Because part of the software in this rootkit was free software that had been released under the new general public license, which is one of the free software licenses in the world. It's the one I recommend for use in the new system. And what the new general public license, or GDPR, says is you're free to redistribute this and include it in other programs, but the whole program that contains this code has to be distributed under the same license, and you have to give the users a copy of the license that they know their rights, and you have to give them or offer them the whole source code so you can do these things. That's commercial copyright infringement, which is, thanks to companies like them, has become a serious crime. Of course, Sony was never prosecuted because our government understood that these laws were meant to strengthen Sony's power over us, not limit Sony in any way. But people did sue Sony. However, they focused their criticism not on the evil purpose of this rootkit, but only on the evil means that were used to carry out the evil purpose. Therefore, Sony was able to settle the suit with them by promising that in the future, when it attacks our freedom, it won't do the other nasty things. And Sony has learned its lesson. In the future, the rootkit will be installed in the machine before you get it, as
Sony did succeed in breaking the digitization curse on the PlayStation 3, and Sony responded in an extremely aggressive manner towards all of the users. Speaking in the book, books began I went to an author, and the author came to me and asked for my cooperation, and I said, I'll cooperate if this e-book is published without DRM, and lets people see it. He went back to the publisher, and the publisher said no, and I said, I insist. So he gave up on the plan, but eventually found another publisher who wanted to do this. In fact, the book was published under a free license that I had written. And it was also published on paper and sold lots of copies. And it's one day after many years of start selling it, and we are going to publish a revised edition soon. So, e-books mostly failed 10 years ago. People just didn't want them. And some people thought, okay, no problem. And I said, then we'll try again. We beat them off one time, but doesn't mean we won the war. Then we'll be back. We have to put them in now. And now we're trying again. With products such as the Sony Shredder. They call it the Mini, but if you get SH, it describes the product more accurately. And the Amazon Swindle, they call it the Kindle, but I think Swindle is more apt because that product is designed to swindle us out of the traditional freedoms of readers. Freedom to do things such as buying a book anonymously paying cash, which is the only way I buy books. But you can't usually do that for the Swindle because the only place most modern books are available for that machine is for Amazon. And Amazon requires buyers to identify themselves, which means that Amazon is making a list of all the books each person, each user of that machine has bought. And this list is such a threat to human rights that it must not be allowed to exist anywhere. And we also traditionally have the freedom to give away a book, or lend a book to our friend, or resell a book, for instance, to a nice bookstore. They take away all those freedoms with digital vehicles. And then there's the freedom to keep the book and read it as many times as you like, keep it as long as you like. The Swindle takes away that freedom with a back door. We found out about the back door in 2009 because Amazon used it in a spectacular way. Amazon deleted lots of copies of a particular book, copies that the users had bought from Amazon. So Amazon knew what they bought. And the book with which Amazon demonstrated the barbarian nature of this product is with 1984 by George Orwell. A book you should read if you haven't yet. But now, well, actually, maybe their name is appropriate. Kindle means to start a fire. That product was designed to burn our books. Amazon said that after the public protest about this, that they wouldn't do it again unless the government told them to. That is awfully comforting. So, this is what the benefits of application are doing to global development. They're strengthening the grip of the companies that want to control what we read and watch and listen to. What would a democratic government do if it were determined to carry out what is good for the citizens and respect their freedom? It would reduce corporate power, not necessarily eliminate it, but reduce it. But how? Here are my proposals. First, as a dimension of time, I suggest that copyright should last for 10 years, starting from the date of publication of the work. Why from the date of publication? Because before the work is published, we don't have copies. So whether we will be allowed to copy them if we have them is an unimportant issue. We might as well let the artist have as long as it takes to arrange publication of the work. Why 10 years? Because in at least some countries, the publication cycle typically lasts only 3 years. In the U.S., for instance, most books that are published are remaindered, which means sold off cheap, within 2 years, and out of print within 3 years. 10 years is more than 3 times the usual publication cycle. So nearly all books would have been dropped anyway within that time. That's why I think 10 years would be a good length of time. But not everyone agrees. I want to propose this on a panel with fiction writers. And the prize-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years, that would be out of the question. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I'm surprised, too. You see, when the publishers demand increased power to attack us, they always demand this in the name of the artists. They pretend they're doing this for the authors. And there are a few authors who make like tremendous hits and superstars who make lots of money, and they actually want the same thing. And they need us to think that all the authors want the same thing. But the fact is, those same companies are grinding most artists into the ground with their heels. But we don't hear about it because those artists are the ones who are not famous. Which is most of them. This author had a dispute with his publisher. You see, his contract said that if his book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. It appeared that his book was out of print because people couldn't get copies, but the publisher refused to admit this and was using the copyright on his book to stop him from distributing copies, which he wanted to do so that people could read it. You see, most artists start out wanting to show their work to people and wanting people to see it, hoping that they would read it. And for the most part, a few artists get so much money that it corrupts them morally and they start making money more than anything else. But that's a tiny few. The rest never get enough money to corrupt them, and they keep on writing the same thing. They want people to see their work. He still wanted people to see his work. And if he wasn't going to get paid, they would still buy them to see his work. He just wanted to hang out to them. And the copyright of his own work was being used to stop him. So he had only had a school with his publisher. He knew that more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to ever do him any good, but he could do him harm. So he said, anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Well, I would insist on 10 years. I just propose it as a good first rough adjustment. Afterwards, we can see you're not going to make it longer or somewhat shorter. If most people wait 5 years, I'll go around with it. four kinds of works based on what kind of contribution they make to society. There are the works of practical use, functional works that we use to do a job. There are the works that say what certain people thought, which you might call works of testimony. And then there are the works of art and entertainment, whose contribution to society is in the impact of the work itself. These contribute to society in different ways, and based on those differences, they have different recommendations about them. First, the practical functional works. These include computer programs, recipes for cooking, educational works, reference works, textbooks, and various other things. These works must be free, because if you use the work to do a job in your life, then if you don't control the work, you won't control your life. And freedom is having control of your life. So you must be free to make the work do what you want and use it as you wish in your life. But you must also be free to publish your version of the work, because there are probably others who will be making your version better, because they want to do the job while you do it. And so, we are back to the conclusion that these works must be free. But some people might say, well, but that would be nice, but if we don't give up our freedom, if we don't let some copyright holder control what we do with this work, then the works will never exist. 20 years ago, we couldn't prove that they were bad. I just said, don't bother living freedom. So far, I don't have freedom, so I won't use it anyway. It's a bad. So even if I don't have much free software, this much free software is better than any amount of not free software. But I couldn't prove we would have lots of free software. But today, we have lots of free software. Today, the empirical evidence shows that that objection is wrong. People do make lots of free works. We just have to make the idea clear in any given area, and lots of people will contribute to making free works. We see the example of the Free Software Committee with tens of thousands of useful free programs. And then there's the example of recipes. Now, look at all the recipes that cooks share and change and redistribute just as if they were legally free. And then there are reference works like Wikipedia, and even free educational works like Wikipedia. And remember, after all, governments finance a lot of educational works, and they can just as well make those works free, and they wouldn't cost any more to write. So that's one category. What about the category of works that say what certain people thought? For instance, memoirs, essays of opinion, scientific papers. For these, the author's name is absolutely crucial. The identity of the author is crucial. Thus, publishing a modified version is just misrepresenting someone. That's not a useful thing in society. So there's no need to allow people to do that. So, what I propose is a partly reduced copyright system, which would cover all commercial use and all modification. But non-commercial redistribution of exact copies is a freedom we must all have. That's the freedom to share. And sharing is good. Sharing builds the bonds of society. To attack sharing is to attack society. So, we must have the freedom to share. But the most we can allow to be covered by copyright. Basically, yes, no. And that would mean successfully legalize sharing, then the nasty aspects of today's copyright enforcement could be eliminated. But what about the third category, which is dark entertainment? For these, it took me years to think about, to reach a conclusion about my four books. Because on the one hand, artistic work can have artistic integrity, and my four books could destroy that integrity. That is sometimes true. Although, when you look at how many of the same artists are now holding them to picture their work totally in exchange for their money, we can see they don't have as much artistic integrity as they want to pretend they have. But there are exceptions. There are some authors who don't know how they want to picture their works. So I guess they do have artistic integrity. But on the other hand, modifying the artistic work can be a contribution to art. Consider, for instance, the folk process, where a series of artists can transform something and produce something very rich. Consider also Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays used stories taken from other works that had been published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect then, those works would have been infringing. They could not have been presented or published, and they would not have been written. And then the copyright holders would say, it's a good thing they would have written because they would have been cheap rip-offs. And since we wouldn't have seen those works, we wouldn't know how absurd that claim is. So, don't believe them when they say that. In any case, what was I going to recommend with arguments on both sides? Eventually, I concluded that a modified version of an artistic work can be a contribution to art, but it's not desperately urgent to publish it. If you're talking about books that you use to do a job, you must be allowed to publish that changed version right away because it's useful for other people. But if you've got a modified version of an artistic work, if you have to wait 10 years for the copyright to expire, in the worst case, you can write that one. Today, waiting for copyright to expire can mean waiting a whole 100 years. You can't write that one, you're done. 10 years, at the most, you could wait. So, what I recommend is the same carefully managed copyright system that covers commercial use and modification, and then in 10 years the copyright expires, and then you can publish your modified version. But in the meantime, we must be free to not commercially share exact copies, because that's the legal freedom we must have for any, absolutely any published work. So, those are my overall recommendations, and then, but there's another point I have to mention, and that is remix. Remix means you take little pieces of various books and you put them together into something that's totally different. And that doesn't even have much in common with the books you got the pieces out of. And that's just illegal, because the only purpose of having a copyright system is to encourage making more books. If you interpret it in such a way that remix is forbidden, that means the system has been perverted to work against its own goal. And that would only happen in a state where private interests have taken control of these laws, which unfortunately is a lot of countries. Now, one consequence is sharing files of published works on the internet must be legal, because sharing is good. Now, other companies would say, that's horrible, you're stealing from the musicians. if you buy the record of a recent record of a well-established superstar, that superstar might in fact probably does get some money from what you paid. But otherwise, no. And the reason is that many musicians who are not famous, when they get a record contract, the record contract is really exploitative. Normally, theoretically, a certain fraction of the money goes to the musician, but they don't get it because the contract says that the production and publicity expenses are treated as an advance to the musicians, which means that when you're buying the CD, that fraction of the money goes from one account of the record company to another account of the record company. It's to quote, pay back the advance, unquote. And it's very rare that any record sells so many copies that it fully pays back the advance. According to
investors and can keep more. So the amount that's actually needed is
and I've seen really start to be released by the licenses that permit sharing. For instance, Citizen of the Blues, which is a work of genius, and Lost in All People, which was pretty good too. Now, better than a lot of the Hollywood pizza, it was done by amateurs. But you see, Hollywood makes crap. And this is not because they're incompetent and they're trying to do a good job and they just never figure out how. No, the system systematically makes crap. This doesn't mean it should be eliminated. I'm against censorship of anything whatsoever because censorship is extremely dangerous. But that's not really the question. The question is not whether people should be allowed to make crap movies. The question is whether they should be able to take away their freedom to help them keep making their crap movies. And I just don't think so. Now, if we go to this for categories 2 and 3, this currently reduced copyright system, which covers commercial use and modification, it will continue providing income to the artists in more or less the same largely inadequate way as the existing system. But we might want to do better than the existing system. We might want to support artists better. I have two and a half, you might say, proposals for how to do this. One is through taxes. We can have taxes on internet connection, or taxes on black discs or both, or we can just use money from the general budget, because it won't be a lot of money. But we can use that to support the arts. The idea is that you take this money, the government collects this money, and then it pays all of that, it distributes all that money to the artists. Based on their success at popularity, which can be measured by quality and sampling. But mapping in that proportion to their popularity. So, you see, if you put it in a linear proportion, suppose Superstar Billy is 1,000 times as popular as successful artist B. That's apt to be said. But I would get 1,000 times as much money as B, if it's the linear way. Which means that in order to provide enough money to B to support B adequately, A has to get tremendously much. Which means my money would be used inefficiently. So I said, let's use a curve like this, maybe Q-root. The point is, that with Q-root, since the Q-root of 1,000 is 10, since A is 1,000 times as popular as B, with the Q-root, A would get 10 times as much as B. Not 1,000 times, but 10 times, meaning A would get less and B would get more than in the linear system. Of course, A would still get more money than B gets, but only 10 times as much, not 1,000 times as much, which means that most of the money would go to supporting a larger number of fairly successful artists. Which means that with less money, we could do a much better job of supporting artists. But I have another suggestion using voluntary payments. Suppose each player had a button that you could push to send maybe here, perhaps, $5 to the artists. Now, we have to just be about, depending on where you are, in the U.S., the proposal in Ghana, in most of the European Union, I think 1 year would probably be okay, but maybe in Greece now, we should be to have a clue. They won't. And that's good. Because we don't have to make poor people support the arts. There are enough people who are not poor who would be glad to support the arts. But the amount of, if you want to count, if you ask to say $5, would that seem like too much when you hesitate? Okay. So that's my point. So then we just have to get people into the habit. And we can do that with public public relations announcements instead of the vicious cruel ones that they make now, trying to convince you that
sharing is theft, or that sharing is like being a pirate, which is ridiculous and goes against human nature. They could have friendly, warm advertisements that say,
did you send some money to an artist this week? One artist, such a small amount of money, you'll never miss it and you'll feel good. Didn't you love what they did? Push the button. And people will, because it feels good. It should be an anonymous payment system. They shouldn't know who is paying money to these artists. They should just know how much they get, how much they get. It's also possible to combine these schemes. But before I go into that, I should mention that some musicians are not successfully supporting themselves through voluntary payments. Or through several things, but the things are more or less symbolic. In effect, they're inviting people to give money and get some token for thanks. But some of them actually offer to do something for you. For instance, some of them say things like, if you give me $10,000, I'll spend a week with you. It probably doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I'm sure both of the parties are glad. Of course, they also have smaller, they typically have a whole bunch of different levels. So if you give them $10, there's some little thing you'll get. Or you give them $50 and you'll get a CD in a beautiful case or something like that. And so they're creative and looking for different ways to encourage people to donate according to their needs. But anyway, there's a way to combine aspects of these two schemes. One of them is it's called the global patronage system. And it was designed by Francis Mugier when France was debating another vicious war to attack people for sharing. And the system works like this. Every internet subscriber would have to pay a certain monthly fee to the ISP for artists, and this money would be divided up among artists. Now, the subscriber would be allowed to take part of that fee, like maybe one third it could be, and somehow split that up among various works. And that amount would get split up as specified, and the amount for each work would be divided among the artists who participated creatively in making that work. The rest, whatever was not allocated, would be then divided up based on the popularity figure computed by from the amounts that people allocated. So, various people would say, give a certain amount to that record or that TV show or whatever. And that would create a popularity figure for the artist behind the work. So these artists would get a popularity figure, and then the rest of the money would be divided based on in proportion to the cube on perhaps of the popularity of each artist. what we should be looking at today. Now, could I have your blue? From 10 level to 10. So, over there we have some stickers from the Gap project that we're asking people to donate what they can. We also have a few pieces of merchandise, some lapel pins and some keyrings, that fairly expensive, so we can't donate them to the place that would be suitable for you. We're charging 10 euros or equivalent. We don't have very many, so if a few of you can buy them, we couldn't do it anyway. But this is a balloon. An adorable balloon. It needs a balloon. And if you have a penguin, then you need a balloon. Because if you don't know that the penguin can't really function without a balloon. For the benefit of the Free Software Foundation. Now, they're fairly expensive. I may not be able to sell it here, but you have to start with it would be 20 or so euros, which I think is 1,300. Yeah. So, well, it's more than 1,200. Yeah. 1,300 sounds right. So, if you did, please offer her up and shout the amount. And I'm going to leave out the. But we still start with 1,300. Do I get 1,300 there? Maybe it's too expensive to sell here, but there's nothing else I can do. I want to sell it on the list and sell it somewhere else. So do I get 1,300? I got 1,300, did I? Say what you get. What? If I get 1,400, do I get 1,500? What? 20. I got 2,000, did I? Do I get 2,100? I got 20, do I get 2,100? I got 21, do I get 22? Do I get 22? I got 23. You can't. was the poem that we started writing in 1990, at a time when we actually barely even started. And we started this because the book needed a cover to be finished. Unfortunately, the cover is not worked out very well, and it's making slow progress on the level to some volunteers, but there are big things that need to be written to make it really good. It may never happen. But it's sort of sad, but that's not what we need most. You see, the machine-independent and free parts of Linux, those are okay. The problem is that Linux, at this point, contains some non-free code, which is binary. I went to an author, and the author came to me and asked for my cooperation, and I said, I'll cooperate if this ebook is published without DRM. He went back to the publisher, and the publisher said no. And I said, I insist. So he gave up on the plan, but eventually found another publisher who wouldn't do this. In fact, the book was published under a free license that I had written. And it was also published by Penguin and South Africa. Thank you. citizens that respect our freedom. It would reduce carbon dioxide, not the society of everybody, but reduce it. But how? Here are my proposals. First, there's the dimension of time. I suggest that copyright should last for 10 years, starting from the date of publication of the book. Why from the date of publication? Because before the book is published, we don't have copies. So whether we would be allowed to copy them if we had them is an unimportant issue. We might as well let the artist have as long as it takes to arrange publication of the book. Why 10 years? Because in at least some countries, the publication cycle typically lasts only 3 years. In the U.S., for instance, most books that are published are remaindered, which means sold off cheap, within 2 years, and out of print within 3. 10 years is more than 3 times the usual publication cycle. So nearly all books would have been dropped anyway within that time. That's why I think 10 years would be a good length of time. Not everyone agrees. I once proposed this at a panel with fiction writers, and the president of fantasy writing sitting next to me said, 10 years, that would be out of the question. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I was surprised too. You see, when the publishers demand increased power to attack us, they always demand this in the name of the artists. They pretend they're doing this for the authors. And there are a few authors who make tremendous hits and superstars who make lots of money, and they actually want the same thing. And they lead us to think that all the authors want the same thing. But the fact is, those same companies are grinding most artists into the ground with their heels. But we don't know about it because those artists are the ones who are not famous, which is most of them. This author had a dispute with his publisher. He says his contract said that if his book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. As it appeared that his book was out of print because people couldn't get copies, but the publisher refused to admit this and was using the copyright of his book to stop him from distributing copies, which he wanted to do so that people could read it. You see, most artists start out wanting to show their work to people and wanting people to see it, hoping that they would read it. And for the most part, a few artists get so much money that it corrupts them morally, and they start making money rather than anything else. But that's a tiny few. The rest never get enough money to corrupt them, and they keep on writing the same thing. They want people to see their work. He still wanted people to see his work. And if he wasn't getting a paid, they would still buy it up and see his work. He just wanted to get out to them. Copyright of his own work was being used to stop him. So he had a legal dispute with his publisher. He knew that more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to ever do him any good, but it could do him harm. So he said, anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Well, I would insist on 10 years. I just propose it as a good first rough adjustment. Afterwards, we could see whether or not we're making it longer or somewhat shorter. If most people work 5 years, I'll go along with it. But what about the dimension of breadth? What activities that copyright cover? Well, there, I distinguish 3 different categories of works based on what kind of contribution they make to society. There are the works of practical use, functional works that we use to do a job. Then there are the works that sign what's as contribution to society is in the impact of the work itself. These contribute to society in different ways, and based on those differences, I have different recommendations about them. First, the practical function of arts. These include computer programs, recipes for cooking, educational works, reference works, text works, and various other things. These works must be free, because if you use the book to do a job in your life, then if you don't control the book, you don't control your life. And freedom is having control of your own life. So you must be free to make the work do what you want and use it as you wish in your life. But you must also be free to publish your version of the book, because there will probably be others who will get your version of it, because they don't want to do the job the way you do it. And so we are back to the conclusion that these works must be free. But some people might say, well, but that would be nice, but if we don't give up our freedom, if we don't let some copyright owner control what we do with this work, then books will never exist. 20 years ago, we couldn't prove them at all. I just said, that we don't have freedom, that we don't have self-aware, we don't have freedom, so we won't use it anyway. It's a bad. So even if we don't have much free software, this much free software is better than any amount of not free software. But I couldn't prove we would have lots of free software. But today, we have lots of free software. Today, the empirical evidence shows that that objection is wrong. People do make lots of free works. We just have to make the idea clear in any given area. And lots of people will contribute to making free works. We see the example of the free software community with tens of thousands of useful free programs. And then there's the example of recipes, where look at all the recipes that cooks try and change and redistribute just as if they were legally free. And then there are reference books like Wikipedia. And even free educational books are beginning. And remember, after all, governments finance a lot of educational works, and they could just as well make those works free. And they wouldn't cost any more to it. So that's one category. But what about the category of works that say what certain people thought? For instance, memoirs, essays of opinion, scientific papers. For these, the author's name was absolutely crucial. The identity of the author is crucial. Thus, publishing a modified version is just misrepresenting someone. That's not a useful thing in society. So there's no need to allow people to do that. So, what I propose is a partly reduced copyright system, which would cover all commercial use and all modification. But, non-commercial redistribution of exact copies is a freedom we must all have. That's the freedom to share. And sharing is good. Sharing builds the bonds of society. To attack sharing is to attack society. So, we must have the freedom to share. But the most we can allow to be covered by copyright. Basically, that's not. And that would mean ending the war on sharing that many governments are prosecuting on behalf of multinational corporations against their citizens. And once we
us to think about, to reach a conclusion about male fairbox. Because on the one hand, artistic work can have an artistic integrity, and male fairbox could destroy that integrity. That is sometimes true. Although, when you look at how much, how many of the same artists allow Hollywood to enter their work totally in exchange for enough money, we can see they don't have as much artistic integrity as they like to pretend they have. But there are exceptions. There are certain authors who don't allow Hollywood to butcher their works. So I guess they do have artistic integrity. But on the other hand, my form of artistic work can be a contribution to art. Consider, for instance, the film process, where a series of artists can transform something and produce something very much. Consider also Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays use stories taken from open books that had been published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect then, those works would have been infringing. They could not have been presented or published, and they would not have been written. And then the copyright holders would say, it's a good thing they weren't written because they would have been cheap ripoffs. And since we wouldn't have seen those works, we wouldn't know how absurd that claim is. So, don't believe them when they say that. In any case, what was I going to recommend with arguments on both sides? Eventually, I concluded that a modified version of artistic work can be a contribution to art, but it's not desperately urgent to publish it. If we're talking about books that you use to do a job, you must be allowed to publish that changed version right away because it's useful for other people. But if you've got a modified version of artistic work, if you had to wait 10 years for the copyright to expire, in the worst case, you can write that now. Today, waiting for copyright to expire can mean waiting 100 years. You can't write that now, you're done. 10 years, at the most, you could write. So, what I recommend is the same carefully reduced copyright system that covers commercial use and modification, and then 10 years the copyright expires, and then you can publish your modified version. But in the meantime, you must be free to non-commercially share and keep copies, because that's the minimum freedom you must have for any, absolutely any published work. So, those are my overall recommendations, and then, but there's one other point I have to mention, and that is remix. Remix means you take little pieces of various works and you put them together into something that's totally different and that doesn't even have much in common with the works you got the pieces out of. And that should just be legal, because the only purpose of having a copyright system is to encourage making more books. If you interpret it in such a way that remix is forbidden, that means the system has been perverted to work against its own goal. And that would only happen in a state where private interests have taken control of these laws, which unfortunately is a lot of countries. Now, one consequence is sharing files of published works on the internet must be legal, because sharing is good. The record companies would say, that's horrible, you're stealing from the musicians. Well, the reason that's not true is that they don't pay the musicians. With a few rare exceptions, namely, non-established superstars. If you buy the record of a recent record of a non-established superstar, that superstar might in fact
I probably does get some money from what you paid. But otherwise, no. And the reason is that many musicians are not famous when they get a record contract. The record contract is really exploitative. Normally, theoretically, a certain fraction of the money goes to the musician, but they never get it because the contract says that the production and publicity expenses are treated as an advance to the musicians, which means that when you buy the CD, that fraction of the money goes from one account in the record company to another account in the record company. It's to, quote, pay back the advance, unquote. And it's very rare that any record sells so many copies that it fully pays back the advance. According to an article that I read in a musician's magazine, the record can even go platinum without finishing paying back the so-called advance, meaning without starting to give any money to the musicians. So the fact that many musicians actually make money, they make it from their concerts, and they're selling things at their concerts. Now, for the longest time, the superstar was different because they finished their first contract. And the thing is, at that point, when they negotiate a new contract, they have clout. So they get a contract that treats them well. And they really do get some of the money when their records are sold. But how they sell their records after the first contract? Those golden records that continue to be under that first contract forever. So, you can't steal what somebody never got and would never get. So, but the musicians are, who have record contracts do get benefit from those contracts through the publicity, because that means more people come to their concerts, and they have more concerts. But that's not the only way to give publicity to music. We can do it by sharing. For instance, just mailing a song to a friend and saying, listen to this. And this is a healthier kind of publicity, because it's not driven by money. So let's get rid of that system. We'll be better off. And besides, those record companies have attacked their freedom. Those are the companies that have sued the teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. They are the ones who have paid legislators to establish more laws to attack us. Those companies deserve only one thing, and that is to be wiped out. I don't see anything wrong with having record companies to sell records. I just bought some records a few minutes before I started the speech. And I got some records of Macedonian music. Which I happen to have worked for a long time, by the way. Because I used to dance to it. But, so record companies, we have a copyright system that might those record companies really pay the musicians. It might be a good thing. Because that's commercial use of the music. But the major record companies of today, they are enemies of the citizens. They deserve to be wiped out and nothing else. Now, it will also be legal to share videos on the internet. And you've heard tremendous figures for how much it costs to make movies. Could we still be made under that proposal? I think so. Producer told me more than half of those figures is actually publicity, not the cost of making a movie. And even the part that's making the movie has been inflated by creative accounting, because if a studio can manage to make the cost seem bigger, then it has less to pay in taxes and less to pay to the investors and can keep more. So the amount that's actually needed is fraction of what we're told. And then consider that a lot of use of movies is commercial use is commercial use. Sure. So the big airplanes is commercial use. Broadcasting them is commercial use. So you put those two things together, and I think maybe still could be made. Something will try to make it work. Good movies for much less money. And I think I've seen movies start to be released with the licenses that come next year. For instance, Santa Sings the Blues, which is a work of genius, and Nasty Old People, which was pretty good too.
Yeah.
create something, you push the button with them. How do I support them? Oppression. Except for the people who are poor. They're not. And that's good. Because we don't have to make poor people support the arts. There are enough people who are not poor who are prepared to support the arts.
Is ridiculous and goes against human nature, they could have friendly, warm advertisements that say,
did you send some money to an artist this week? Why not? It's such a small amount of money, you'll never miss it, and you'll feel good. Didn't you love what they did? Push the button. And people will, because it feels good. It should be an anonymous payment system. They shouldn't know who's paying money to these artists. They should just know how much they get, how much they get. It's also possible to combine these schemes. But before I go on to that, I should mention that some musicians are now successfully supporting themselves through voluntary payments. Through certain things, but the things are more or less symbolic. That in effect, they're inviting people to give money and get some token for thanks. But some of them are actually offer to do something for you. For instance, some of them say things like, if you give me $10,000, I'll spend a week with you. It probably doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I'm sure both of the parties are glad. Of course, they also have smaller, they typically have a whole bunch of different levels that if you give them $10, there's some good thing you'll get. Give them $50 and you'll get a CD in a beautiful place or something like that. And so the creative are looking for different ways to encourage people to donate according to their needs. But anyway, there's a way to combine aspects of these two schemes. One of them is it's called the Global Patronage System. And it was designed by Francis Mounier when France was debating another vicious war to attack people for sharing. And the system looks like this. Every internet subscriber would have to pay a certain monthly fee to the ISP for artists, and this money would be divided up among artists. Now, the subscriber would be allowed to take part of that fee, not maybe one third, it could be, and somehow split that up among various works. And that amount would get split up as specified, and the amount for each work would be divided among the artists who participated creatively in making that work. The rest, whatever was not allocated, would be then divided up based on the popularity figure computed back from the amounts that people allocated. So, various people would say, give a certain amount to that record or that TV show or whatever. And that would create a popularity figure for the artist behind the book. So these artists would get a popularity figure, and then the rest of the money would be divided based on, in proportion to the queue the popularity of each artist. So there are various ways of designing systems to support the arts that are not based on forbidding people or stopping people from copying. And that's what we should be looking at today. Now, so over there we have some stickers from the group project, and we're asking people to donate what they can. We also have a few pieces of merchandise, some power pins and some keychains, but they're fairly expensive, so we can't deliver them to the place that will be suitable for you, which is the 10-year-old equivalent. We don't have very many, so if a few of you can buy them, that we couldn't do that anyway. But this is a canoe. An adorable canoe. It needs a home. And if you have a penguin, then you need a canoe. Because as we all know, a penguin can't really function without a canoe. For the benefit of the Free Software Foundation. Now, they're fairly expensive. I may not be able to sell it here, but they have to start with, it would be 20,000 euros, which I think is 1,300 dollars.
Your turn, you will get your chance.
groups. We started this because we needed a cutoff to be finished. Unfortunately, the development has not worked out very well, and it's making slow progress on the lives of some volunteers, but there are big things that need to be rewritten to make it really good. It may never happen. But it's sort of sad, but that's not what we need most. You see, the machine-independent and free parts of Linux, those are okay. The problem is that